Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to the second episode of 2021 for the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am your host, as always, Malt Char. And I think you enjoyed last week's episode. That's certainly the feeling I got from the feedback. So we're going to do it again. Part two of the Kev O'Neill interview will be out in 7 days' time. It's already recorded. We had a great time, a few laughs. He's got some very strong opinions about dragons, as it turns out. So, looking forward to that. However, this week we have a pre-arranged interview with John Sanders. Now, those of you who know your 2000 AD history will know exactly who John is. But for those of you who don't, he was the head of IPC's youth group. Now, this was 2000 AD's original publisher. So he was the guy who bought in Pat Mills, people like John Wagner, to create 2000 AD, and was there for an awful lot of the heyday history. He's particularly well known for his policy of hatch, match, and dispatch, where new titles would be launched. They would be, when they started to fall in sales, they would be forwarded into other titles. Other titles would be cancelled completely. He was there for and in charge of this incredibly rich period for the British comic book industry. So it was a delight last year, before everything kicked off, to sit down with him and chat about King's Reach, which is the memoir that's out now from Rebellion Publishing. Now, this is an account of 25 years of his publishing career in comics. Some very interesting insights there, including his opinions on Robert Maxwell. So it was great to be able to sit down with John, who's one of those names that often comes up in histories of 2000 AD, but has never really had much of an opportunity to speak for himself. So make sure you pick up a copy of King's Reach to go alongside this this interview. Enjoy. In a week's time, we'll be back with Kev O'Neill, and we're setting up some really interesting, really good interviews for the next few weeks. Very exciting. So hopefully this episode finds you well. I've been getting some emails from a few people who've said that the podcast is helping them get through some fairly rough times, whether you're isolating on your own or whether you're just working from home and need a bit of a distraction. Hopefully the Thrillcast is here to provide that for you. So let's crack on with the interview with John Sanders, which was recorded last year. John, it's lovely to actually meet you, particularly far in advance of the publication of King's Reach, which is your memoir about your time in publishing, and specifically in comics. I wanted to, I guess, start at the very beginning, because your background is in newspapers. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that and how you came to have an interest in magazines and comics?
Yeah, I fell out of the cradle wanting to write, to be a journalist. Joined the local paper when Brighton Evening Argus, when I was about 15. Cleaned out the office files and swept the floor and all that sort of thing. But the trick was to get onto the reporter's day book, which I quickly mastered. And eventually, in a couple of years, was deputy chief sub-editor of the sister paper, Sussex Daily News. But I had this uneasy feeling at the time, which was quite long, that newspapers would die and the magazines would last forever. Probably the reverse has happened. But magazines fascinated me because you had more time to think about them. You don't get any time on a newspaper, as you know. You know, you get four editions a day and they've got to be right or else. So I designed a magazine. I did a magazine at school, actually, and I quite liked it, an underground magazine. I like the feel of doing magazines and putting your personality into them. So I designed a magazine for young women, a new type of magazine, which I think it was new anyway, which had never been seen before, and took it around a couple of publishing houses, and I was taken on. As the irony of all this sort of story is that the magazine was never published for political reasons in the House at the time, but I was presented with a rough dummy of Look and Learn, which a lot of your older viewers will remember as the first educational magazine in the UK. I liked it, I redrafted it, got going with it, and it was a tremendous success. 300,000 copies a week at four times the cover price of a comic was going some in those days. And it was a very exciting time.
Because the context, the industry at the time was, I mean, it's almost alien to us now, dominated by a few big publishers, but also lots of little smaller houses, but selling millions and millions of copies every single week. You mention in the early chapters about the absolute dominance of the women's magazines, things like Women's Weekly and things like that. Your experience of that industry, there's not that many people still with us who have such an intimate knowledge of that period. Can you want to give us a flavour of what it was like working in that kind of huge, I mean, it was a huge industry.
It was kind of domestic and local to be in one of the big three magazine houses at that time. They were all in central London, within a mile of each other. And there was tremendous rivalry. I was in one of them, Amalgamated Press, which morphed into Fleetway Publications. They were joined together at the time of when asset stripping was very popular, by Cecil Harmsworth King, who was chairman of the Mirror and a descendant of Lord Northcliffe, the first journalist, of course, as you probably know. And they were brought together in a skyscraper on the South Bank in London, 2,500 people. And the competitive spirit was taken away from them, obviously, because the name of the game was making money. That was a great shame. But the comics, we're talking about the comics, retained their separate identity because they had come basically from one house, Fleetway. Their problem was, as much as anything, that they should not have been lumped together with women's weeklies, which four of which, out of 150 titles, four of them made 60% of the profit of the International Publishing Corporation. But obviously, they were going to get precedence above everything else. Mm. It was very, very difficult, if you were in comics, to expect top-class treatment when top-class treatment was going to go to the editor of Woman and Woman's Own and Horse and Hound, may I say, Country Life, with one of ours, New Scientist. We were very close to the bottom. Mm. In fact, we were the bottom. And the fact that we were eventually, under my stewardship, 30 weekly titles didn't make it very easy for the sales reps when they went into the wholesalers on a Friday afternoon in June, and it was hot, and they had a list of over 100 titles to be ordered. They started with Woman, Woman's Own, Woman's Weekly, Woman's Realm, Country Life, Horse and Hound, New Musical Express, going right down through the list. And they didn't come at number 70 to Ginty or 2000 AD. They just said, they're comics. Mm. So the 30 comics were given an order, whether they were good or bad. This is one of the problems of being in a very large corporation where you didn't fit. We were in the wrong place with the wrong people at the wrong time. And if we'd been a separate unit, we would have done much better. We would have had an independent distributor. We would have had more choice over printers. And we wouldn't have been unionised. Because as soon as you get to 2,500 people, you've got the unions. And I'm talking about the 1970s, when the unions were a political force and dominated everything, particularly the print and publishing industry.
Yeah. We'll come back to talk about the unions in a bit. One thing I wanted to ask about was this dummy that you mocked up, Twirl, which was the idea that you took around various publishers. In hindsight, what was different about that? What had you done with that you didn't think was being done by anybody else?
Well, I wanted to produce stuff that was that hadn't been done by anyone else, and there were plenty of examples of that. You essentially pushed back frontiers, which I did later on when I was working for IPC. Produced a raft of magazines which pushed back frontiers. Teenage girls were not well catered for in the 60s and 70s by the media, by their magazines, which ignored a lot of their problems, ignored the fact that they were struggling with their identity, just produced jolly stories, and really in the days of Daisy Pulls It Off, you know, jolly hockey sticks and stuff like that. So the field wasn't difficult to enter, didn't seem to me to be anyway. We were pushing back the frontiers in boys' comics. Why couldn't we do it with teenage magazines? What did you do? I mean, all this has been done. It sounds awfully old hat. It's been done since, because nearly 50 years have passed. But what did you do on your first date? And that sort of thing, you know. I mean, don't ask me, because I was as gauche as anybody. I just imagined it.
Because a lot of people think about that kind of mentality as being something that came along with the teen magazines that girls' comics kind of evolved into in the 1980s and 1990s. But we're talking 60s and 70s here. Why were you so sold on this idea? Why were you so confident that it is what you wanted to do?
I'm producing a teenage magazine. I wasn't really sold on that idea. I had half a dozen other magazines in my head for different markets. I can't remember all of them now, but I had a crime magazine in my head. I had a history magazine in my head. Why did I produce Whirl then? I don't know. I just liked drawing boards, I think, and coloured crayons, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a very unexplored market at that time. And, of course, it's soon got rumbled on that one. When I produced a teenage magazine, which was attracting the attention of the media, I was invited on television, I remember, and a feisty old presenter said, "Do you teach the girls to use contraception?" And I said, "Good heavens, no, we don't do anything like that." "Well, then you are creating big problems for them, don't you see?" So the next time I went on, they said, "Do you teach the girls to use contraception?" And I said, "Of course we do." "Ha, you're promoting promiscuity. You couldn't win." And that's how it was.
Right.
You know.
I mean, you mentioned Look and Learn there, which was a changed the game to a certain extent because it was an educational title, as you say. It was a higher price point than comics at the time. Tell us a bit about the number one, the evolution of that idea, and number two, those early days when you were putting that together and getting it out to market.
Well, I'd come from the Daily Sketch, and full of tabloid fire. And I was features editor of the Sketch, and I enjoyed that sort of approach to any kind of story. And it occurred to me that it could be applied to learning. Mm. And Look and Learn was the first educational magazine. It was detested in the office, detested by the board, but they could do nothing about it because it's making a lot of money, making a huge amount of money, actually. It was much more successful than anybody thought would be. So I had a lot of advisors all around me from the board who didn't like it, you know, and from top executives who didn't think it should be read. The truth of the matter was, Look and Learn was pretty successful because parents read it. Mm. Parents wanted to be educated. And the other secret of its success was that I was very uneducated myself. So every time I came to a story, it was like discovering something new. Mm. This is wonderful, you know. I'll tell you something about Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn now, and you'll have never read it in any textbook. And it was given tabloid treatment. Mm. Now, it's all been done, of course, since then on television by people like Lucy Wolseley,
oh, yeah,
who dress up for it, and it's very effective. I like to think that the germ of some of those ideas on television came from Look and Learn. There was no television to speak of anyway when we produced Look and Learn. And, you know, it ran for 25 years very, very successfully, made a great deal of money for Fleetway, and some of the happiest. I left it after 3 years because I wanted to do something different, but it was certainly some of the happiest times of my life.
Let's talk about the actual physical process of bringing these things to market, because, you know, this was before computers, this was before InDesign and Corel and all things like that. Was this you sat with editors, sub-editors, freelancers, running through things, or was it a case of, you know, centrally coming up with ideas and then farming them out?
I think I was a pretty hands-on editor.
Mm.
Yeah, in my editing days, I didn't like anything going through that I hadn't seen. But I didn't have a problem with that. You know, I just sort of sat with the subs when we were going to press, read the pages, and there was no hierarchy as such, you know. There were 16 of us on the title, and we were always busy all the time, all of us. It wasn't a problem with of hierarchy or who does what and who's got this title and that title. No, it wasn't a problem. Biggest problem, really, on Look and Learn was from outside the paper, from outside the magazine, with people in the company, which was very old-fashioned, very stoical company. It didn't like, really, the arrival of this tabloid newspaper man who was producing a weekly paper. And you've got to remember that Fleetway Publications was spawned out of the Amalgamated Press. And the Amalgamated Press was one of the most didactic companies in the country. It had a huge history, a huge legacy of teaching encyclopedias, the Children's Encyclopedia, Children's Newspaper, all very prim and proper.
Mm.
So we were doing something completely different. I like doing things that are different, you know.
that notion of coming in being a to a degree a disruptive element, you talk in the book about as you arrived, other people walked out the door, whether they did it intentionally or not. Did this cause you a lot of problems down the line?
You're referring to a man who had been put in situ as the embryonic editor before me.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's an old Fleet Street trick, isn't it? You know, you've been given a seat and you go in and you sit on it and somebody else has already got it. So I was sort of prepared for that, partly prepared for it. But they put in this chap who wasn't really very interested in it, in the magazine, but he thought it would give him some kudos in Chelsea, where he lived, and where he was very well known. I think it was a mistake. Must be very difficult for a publishing company to take in somebody like me from outside, particularly one which is very set in its ways. In those days, to take in someone like me and say, you can do this, you can do exactly what you like, that would be very hard even today. Mm. And I was kind of revolutionary, you know, in my youth, and I wanted to do everything completely differently from the way that you'd been taught to do it. And it worked. Mm. And when it worked, of course, they couldn't do anything about it, because it's all about money.
Yeah, you described when IPC was amalgamated into a single company, you describe it as the Ministry for Magazines. Yeah. And your exact quote is, the Ministry for Magazines was a disaster for IPC and a tragedy for British comics. Do you want to elaborate
on that? I mean, these three companies, which we talked about, which were joined together, had a heritage that went back to the 19th century. All that heritage was destroyed by the creation of IPC magazines. The comics were bundled in with the magazines. The comics had always been produced by a separate company, Amalgamated Press, and they had a wonderful history of their own. Billy Bunter, Rockfist Rogan, wonderful titles, and they sank to the bottom of the magazine ordering pile when they all went to this skyscraper, King's Reach, were effectively all bundled together. Yeah, it was called the Ministry of Magazines because there were so many of them. And one of the problems, or the chief problem in my view, was the board was then created of people who had no editorial background whatsoever. No structure was created for innovation. No structure existed for creating new magazines. The board was basically accountants and advertising people and printers. Why printers were put on the board, I don't know. But the effect of this was that you had a board that did not understand how to create a magazine. And very significantly, in the 25 years that I was at IPC, I launched over 100 comics, and in the rest of the magazine areas, nothing was launched at all. Mm. And that's a terrible indictment, really, if you think about it. And it makes me quite cross, because if a proper structure had been created for innovation, I had two studios, for example, in my group. Chaps just working on new ideas that myself or my executives could go in and talk to them about. And we had free hand to do this. This was a cost that we expected to carry. I was quite happy to carry, and it was a cost. I had nothing like it at all, absolutely nothing like it at all in any of the other six or seven magazine groups. Mm. I would complain about this from time to time. But, you know, aren't you the comics man? Would be the response, you know. So it didn't work.
That brings
it was a tragedy.
That brings us to Hatch, Match and Dispatch, which is the old title for the personal announcements at the back of a newspaper, but in comics specifically refers to the creation, the merger and the closing of titles based on their performance. Was that a notion, an idea you came to in a flash, or was it something that had evolved over time in your mind?
No, it was a marketing strategy which had to be used. The opposition had 50% of the market, DC Thompson's in Dundee. They had all the advantages. They were a private company. They weren't unionised. They could therefore keep their cover prices much, much below ours. They did their own printing. So they could wriggle the prices the way they wanted. We were in the free market. So our cover prices were perforce full start. Yeah, we had to innovate all the time. Okay, there was one Beano. It sold, I don't know, 500,000 copies a week. It was unchallengeable as a single title. But what I could do is produce five Beanos selling 100,000 copies a week. And then when one got to be a bit ailing, I could put two together. Inertia in the trade then allowed the circulation to stay more or less fixed for a few months while I did another one, produced another one, and then that was merged into off the hoof strategy, if you like, but it worked.
What do you think that did to readers' perceptions of titles?
Well, children have enormous loyalty to their comic, or had an enormous loyalty to it, but out of the corner of their eyes, they always liked something new, particularly if it had a free gift, a piece of plastic fallout. So they could be loyal to their one comic, but still go and buy, because remember they always bought two or three or four. They'd still go and buy the new one out of curiosity. And if the new one started being very effective, started being a comic they liked, then they would change their loyalty. So I didn't have a problem with that. That wasn't a problem.
Do you think it also made it easier for children to jump out of reading comics? If comics that they enjoyed stuck around for only a year, maybe 18 months, do you think that had a knock-on effect to the way that they perceived the disposability of the medium as well?
No, not exactly like that. Children gave up comics when puberty arrived. They would not any longer suffer the picture strip idea. It was different in Europe, different in America. You could sell picture strips to teenagers and to adults in those countries. But because our comics were all own brand in the UK and had been since the 1890s, you gave them up when you were 12 or 13 because it was kid stuff, wasn't it? You didn't read it anymore. What you went on to, I don't know. Girls, I imagine, but you certainly didn't read comics after puberty.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's a strange sort of cut-off point, but that's the way it was.
Because I've heard people say, "Oh, with a big publishing company like IPC, you know, when kids stop reading comics, they move on to something else when they're preteens or when they're teenagers." But it doesn't sound as if that was an actual strategy that IPC had, that they actually cared what happened to these readers once they'd stopped.
No, I don't think IPC cared very much at all about its comics, actually. They were a nuisance. When I proposed finally to the chief executive that we should be sold, He nearly fell off his chair with delight, because I think we were a nuisance. We didn't conform to any of the rules. We didn't do, we didn't fit in with the unions, what the unions wanted. We were on the different pay rates. We had different rules for ourselves. I think today we managed to crash the barrier of teenage reading with 2000 AD. It was always my ambition to try to get something going that would appeal to teenagers in picture strip. And I think 2000 AD did that. And it's been followed through now by graphic novels, of course.
Was there any hint that people understood or even acknowledged that resale market, the idea of packaging these things up? Because even when Titan started doing the early graphic novels, they only did some. They didn't do everything. But now virtually everything that you see published goes into a graphic novel of some type.
Well, of course, it was early days for me. And there is tremendous emphasis in a graphic novel on the two contributors, the writer and the artist. And although we were moving towards that sort of thing, clearly the writer and the artist were going to share most of the spoils. And it seemed to me that there wasn't going to be much room left for the corporation, for people taking the risk and that sort of thing. Graphic novels, like comics, really belong in a small unit. I know that some of them have been successful. I've heard of 2 million sales and that sort of thing on recent ones. But that's all been a progression. It was too early in my day to. They were around. I liked them. I liked the way they were done. I liked the cover prices particularly that they could command. But I didn't think there would be a lot in it for us. After all, you write a story and get an artist to draw it. You know, don't want to go sharing it with every Tom, Dick and Harry who's in a big unionised corporation.
Yeah.
No, that would have been difficult.
Because, of course, those are the days when you didn't have creator credits on strips.
I didn't like credits.
Yeah.
For children's comics because it invited other publishers to come and steal them from you.
Right. Okay. With the Hatch, Match and Dispatch, obviously, and you mentioned this in the book, that there's some tough decisions to make with titles that perhaps might surprise people. So something like Eagle, for example, which was a... I think you describe it in terms of putting it out of its misery at the end of its life. With those tough decisions, were you conscious of the impact on people who had been doing the art and the writing for these, or was there so much going on that it was a case of, we'll move from one thing onto another?
Well, there's not a lot of room for sentiment in comics. We were working too fast and too fast. We were in too much of a hurry. I used to say to people, look, if you've got an affinity with your title and I've had to close it, go home and cry for the rest of the night, come in the next morning and there'll be a job here for you on a new title. And you just have to join up and get some loyalty to something new. Interestingly, one of our chaps left years later, was on the Mirror and wrote to me and said, you had said this to me at the time, and I found it enormously, gave me a great lift, and I was very pleased about it. And that's well, if your words of wisdom can be remembered 20 years later, couldn't be that bad, you know.
I want to move on to talking about battle action in 2000 AD, because that late 70s period was a remarkable you know, people describe it as a revolutionary period where you had Pat Mills, you had John Wagner, Alan Grant coming in, creating these comics that seemed to say something different, that seemed to offer something that hadn't been offered before. Now, you talk in the book about the level of violence and excitement that comics were beginning to offer. Do you want to talk a little bit about...
The word that I used to use constantly in the office was realism.
Mm.
By realism, it was interpreted that I meant violence.
Yeah.
Violence is a nasty word, but the truth is we were being overshadowed by children's stories on television and what children could watch on television. For example, I'll move aside for a minute, we produced a horror comic and I was terribly worried about it, and the board were terribly worried about it, and it was launched and it bombed. It was terribly unsuccessful, to the point where for the first time in my life I called in some market research to find out why, and the reason why was everybody said we'd seen worse things on television. Well, you know, when you're up against that sort of thing, you've got to think, what am I going to do? Anyway, Action was produced. Action had some fantastically good stories in it. We sat around in rooms like this with linoleum floors well into the evening with people like Mills and Wagner and Grant and devising stories. And they were wonderful times for me because... You know, I had my editorial hat on as a publisher, which was great fun. But we got the thing right. We got some wonderful stories going. And unfortunately, one tipped over the top when a bottle was thrown at a football match and hit the goalkeeper. And somebody said, good shot. Well, you can't do that sort of thing. It was an editorial mistake. But we were crucified for it. And... as you probably know, as most people know, Action was taken off under public pressure and brought back a very limp-looking magazine or comic, and died about 4 weeks later because it had departed from its original script. But I still had this terrible bee in my bonnet about violence called realism. And then one of the editors suggested that it should be a sci-fi idea with the violence coming from a lawman. So we created The Cursed Earth, which had been wiped out by a bomb, and people were running mad, killing each other and that sort of thing. The law was in the hands. It was then put in the hands of one man who had the rights to... a bit like a Wild West sheriff, actually.
Mm.
That was where the idea sprang from. A Wild West sheriff who operated in a future world, but who had all the power of a Wild West sheriff. He could execute and hang and do it. And this was Judge Dredd. He could do all these things. And Judge Dredd was violent, and all the stories were violent, because they were all in the name of the law.
Mm.
And people accepted that. I wish I'd thought of it before I'd launched Action. Life would have been much easier.
What was your relationship like with Pat and with John and with Alan when in this very early period?
Oh, well, they probably thought I was a nuisance, and I thought they were a nuisance. They were... no, we had a good relationship. I like to think they were very much their own people. They did strange things. I remember going out to a place called Billerica, which is somewhere in England, to a house in the middle of a field to meet them once, and they were all sitting round a table in a freezing kitchen devising stories. And that's how it was. It wasn't the way I worked, but I accepted it was the way they worked.
Mm.
And I like to think that I thought they were all very, very good people, and deserved everything they got. But of course, like a lot of very, very good people, they thought they should have more. And we weren't in a position to give them more, or I wasn't, without destroying the whole edifice of the company. You could always leave, you know, and start up your own. Start up your own 2080 if you could, if you had enough talent to do that. But they didn't. They preferred to stay under the umbrella of a big corporation, as I did. And you've got to accept them, the downside of that as well as the upside.
Because you do acknowledge in the book the unique qualities that, that those guys had. Because you said for example, they picked Zarjazz, which was the proposed monthly sister title for 2000 AD, and various other ideas. I think you told David Bishop in Thrill Power Overload you would have loved to have cloned Mills and Wagner and Grant, but you could never find that spark of what had created 2000 AD in the first place. Was that a frustration that endured?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Talent is very, very hard to find. Good talent. Mills had enormous talent. Wagner had enormous talent. But they could only do so much. I had some enormously talented people, but they were working up to their necks, you know. They could only do so much. Their focus was on one thing. I mean, they did 2000 AD. They did it superbly. But they couldn't have done two or three 2080s, which is what I wanted. Mm. It's very easy for management to sit up there on its golden throne and say, I want another one, I want another one, which I was doing all the time and harassing them. And they would try. But because they were so busy on what had to go to press, they just couldn't do it. Mm. Very difficult. I found the most difficult thing in management was finding talent. Yeah.
There was an incident in 1980 when there was a strike on, and you very nearly wielded the axe for 2000 AD. Mm. I mean, I probably don't need to ask this question. Are you glad that you didn't?
Yeah, but they were making life a bit difficult. Mm. One of the problems were these very talented people wanted it all for themselves. They wanted a piece of the action. They wanted equity. They wanted everything. But they were still union members, and they went to union meetings. And when people said there should be something for everyone, they said, yes, there should be something for everyone. Do you follow me? There's a dichotomy in their thinking.
Yeah.
I can think of one particular guy who wanted a great deal, but he was very left-wing. And like a good left-winger, he wanted something for everybody as well. And you can't have both. You know, the cake is only so big. They were making a nuisance of themselves like that. And I did get very fed up with it. And I did think of taking the axe to 2000 AD, yeah. Am I glad I didn't? Well, when I see all these chaps working on it now...
I'm very glad you didn't. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a job.
There you are. Are we through?
Okay, I just got two more questions. Yeah, all right. One of the things I did want to ask is, considering that you were, in the early days, that disruptive influence who came into the company and stirred everything up and disrupted the way they've been doing things, did it rankle to a certain extent that to people like John and Pat and Alan, you seemed like the company man in the way that
You soon turn into a company man, I can tell you that. You can have all these revolutionary ideas when you come in and you can spread them around and put them there. But when you start going up the greasy pole, you become a company man and you realise that there are rules and you have to follow them. But I had a lot of sympathy for them. I knew what they were about. They were very well treated. I did something that I hope you will make a note of. In the case of Pat Mills, I needed him so badly, and I thought he was so talented. I actually paid him for a year twice as much as I was getting myself from the company.
And that was to...
I saw your jaw drop.
I'd love to be paid twice what I want. Final question, because we are running out of time. The market has changed. The newsstand is completely different. IPC sold... Well, Egmont, as it became, sold 2000 AD to us, and now we have picked up the rest of the archive. And it is an archive. These comics aren't being produced anymore. You know, we choose titles for specials and do the collections, but 2000 AD is still going. How do you feel about that now?
Well, I'm very happy. I'm very happy when I look around here and see all this industry and people beavering away just as we used to. It's something which really in my time had died. Mm. But yeah, I'm very, very happy about it. But you know, life goes on. Life is a progression. And strange though it may seem to you, while all these new things are happening, I am nearly 90, and it's time I bowed out.
Well, thanks so much to John for chatting about King's Reach, which is out now from Rebellion Publishing. It's really weird to see myself in a time before the pandemic. Yeah. Very odd to think that was a year ago. But in the meantime, we're still going to continue broadcasting from the Thrillcast. Like I said, in a week's time, second part of the Kev O'Neill interview. So make sure you don't miss that. Do help spread the word about the Thrillcast. All the feedback seems to be really positive. Leave a review if you can on whatever service you listen to. Yeah, we'll see you in a week's time. Quite a lot of exciting news coming out over the next week. I'll say no more. Yeah, we can talk about that in the future. Until then, hope you're staying safe. Hope you're taking care of one another. And until then, Splendid Vertwig.
Alert! 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 Fill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.